Welcome, Maggie, to Beyond DEI. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest today, and I'm really excited to talk about your work and racialequitytools.org and our partnership and how RET is now a part of Equity in the Center, and just your thoughts on operationalizing race equity, how tools and resources fit in, and why you thought EIC would be a good place for RET to have a home moving forward. So to start, it would be helpful if you could share a bit about yourself, your background and experience, all the decades of it in race equity work, and anything else you might like to share with our listeners.
Okay. Well, it's great to be on this call with you, Kay, and I'm really excited just to have the conversation and just gap for a while.
Me too.
So, you know, I guess I want to start on and I'm currently living on the unceded territory of the Susquehannock, which is in York Township, Pennsylvania. But I grew up on the unceded territory of Erie and Kaskaskia and Mississauga, which is now referred to Cleveland, Ohio, and South Euclid specifically. It's one of those suburbs. And I'd say that my parents and my maternal grandma were the first who sort of shared the messages of fairness and justice. But as a white girl growing up in a white suburb that moved from the west side of Cleveland, which was the more diverse area, to the white suburb for better education, I was constantly trying to deal with some of the covert messages of who is worthy, you know, or what is good. And that was all racialized. So, you know, just starting to question and address. So just so folks have a little bit of context in terms of my background, I got super excited about a graduate program at the School of Ed at UMass Amherst that was focused on social justice education and organizational development. And it had this great faculty folks, Bailey Jackson and Rita Hardiman, who did some of the racial identity development, and Maureen Adams, who did the social justice education. And I was putting myself through graduate school, working full-time as a residence director. I have a 22-floor tower building that I was working on. It was mostly freshmen and sophomore folks who identified as male. So it was a crazy time for me. And in 1986, there was a lot of campus racial violence and tension that was happening across the country. And UBS was not immune, even though out of all the colleges and universities, it probably had a little bit more infrastructure in terms of programs. And after the last game of the World Series, a gang of white football players surrounded and attacked a black man who lived in my building. And there was a series of other violent attacks that happened that evening. And so, you know, you can imagine from a university scale how they were going to address it. And that really was my point of no return. It was me making sure that my role and responsibility was to work for racial justice. And that whole process was a way to educate me in a whole new way about more of the system and the culture piece that I wasn't aware of earlier on. And I met a woman when I was in St. Louis, working at St. Louis Effort for AIDS, Mary Weber, who had started this dismantling racism program at NCCJ. It was the National Conference of Community and Justice. And for those old folks, it used to be the National Conference for Christians and Jews. And so she asked me to continue her work when she moved away. And in the late 90s, a group of us designed and facilitated a residential dismantling racism institute. And we were real strategic in trying to identify folks in different key sectors and different positions to go through it and then make a 2-year commitment of working in the community. And then we started building our base through community workshops and dialogue groups. And then we launched Community St. Louis with the emphasis on unity. And we brought representatives from across the sector. And we were part of the first wave of comprehensive community initiatives focused on racial equity following the work of Project Change. And I encourage folks to check out what Project Change accomplished in the 90s. There's some information about it on racial equity tools. And then just finally, I moved to Maryland, worked at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and that's one of the oldest Black think tanks in the country. And Mike Wanger, who was at the President's Clinton's Initiative on Race, he started NEIBOR, Network of Alliances Bridging Race and Ethnicity, and we had 180 race relations and racial justice organizations, and we supported them, you know, with programs and tech. And you have to imagine online tech in 2001 was a lot different than it is now.
Was it really online tech in 2001?
It was an experiment. And then I started consulting in 2004. So, you know, I'm focusing on operationalizing racial justice, working with white folks. And you know, I've written several pieces and developed some tools. So probably longer than you wanted, but that was a little background.
No, that was really helpful to hear, Maggie, because there are different aspects of your story that I've heard, but I've not heard them threaded together in that way, which sort of tells the story of your evolution as an activist and an organizer. And in our conversations with our Deep Equity practitioners, network colleagues, you're always super intentional about leading with movement. Like, what is our strategy for movement and organizing? And so I could hear that in how you were telling the story of your increasing awareness around racial justice and the broader system and how it all fits together. So I really enjoyed hearing that.
And I think just one quick thing, I think it's one thing to talk about ancestry to understand our conditioning in terms of doing that. But what I wanted to share that information for, it's also important to understand our lineage, our spiritual and our cultural and political lineage, because those were the supports that were necessary for me to challenge my thinking and growth as a white person working for racial justice. And I want to just, in some ways, hold up the people of the shoulders that I stand on.
Yeah, no, that's really important. And as you were telling the story and naming people's names, that really resonated with me because we don't always do that when we're telling the stories of like how we learned or from whom we learned. And you started with your mother and your aunt. And I feel like each of us has that thread that we can pull. And for those of us that work in racial justice or racial equity, generally, if you ask people how they got here, there is a family member or a couple of family members who had an influence on them during childhood that, you know, sort of pulls a direct line to how they ended up doing what they do today. So I enjoyed hearing who that was for you. We each have that person. And then all, like you're saying, all the folks along the way on whose shoulders you stand. So I appreciate the story. And you're naming how this all fits together for you as a white person working for racial justice and developing an awareness of how you fit into the broader system. I'm also really amused that you were in a building of mostly undergraduate. I mean, I'm sure there's like all, you got a lot of stories. So we can
right,
come back
I
to
do.
That. We can come to
I do. We won't talk
later,
about that, the cow. Well, that'll be another
oh
podcast.
Oh my goodness. That's it. Yes, I'm getting Animal House vibes from that whole phase of your life. But thank you for sharing. And it was so sad to hear about the young man who was attacked following the football game. And what it made me think of is how often those melees happen after large sporting events, but when they involve white folks, they're not called riots.
Yes.
Even correct. Though they involve violence and destruction of property. So I'm sorry that he had that experience and that you had to be part of managing the trauma of what unfolded after that. Let's talk a little bit about how racialequitytools.org came to be, or Racial Equity Tools came to be. At the end of your introduction, you referenced in passing like a couple of articles and some resources that you developed, which is a very large understatement. You're so humble. You, more than anyone I've ever encountered in this space, have written and shared more resources than I could even count. And Racial Equity Tools is the largest online library of racial equity and justice tools and resources. So tell us a little bit about how it came to be. And as you said, you also balance that work with your own practice and writing. And I know we'll come back to that too, but RET, how did it get started?
Yeah, so I have to make one comment about family on this. So my dad, who used to just go to the libraries all the time and get books and go to those, you know, dollar bag sales, we were always joked around that our attic would fall in because we had so many books. So you know where I got my love of resources.
Okay. That does make sense. And Andrew and I have always marveled at your capacity to do research while at the same time doing organizing and then racial equity tools. But that, okay, so you grew up gathering, organizing lots of data, and you had a library in your attic, which makes sense because you curate the largest online library of racial equity tools. So we owe that to your dad.
Yes. So I met Sally Lederman. We were both doing technical assistance at the Casey Foundation, you know, that Making Connections place-based initiative that was happening. And we felt there was a need for a clearinghouse of resources. And actually, racial equity tools started as evaluation tools for racial equity back in 2005. And you know that evaluation and racial equity weren't in a lot of sentences together. So, you know, we worked really hard at identifying the resources, and also we created a lot of tip sheets and we piloted them out in the community. So we really got some great feedback on them, and that's how that was created. And we realized, though, to deepen and make sure that evaluation, racial equity, we're in the same sentence. We had to deepen the knowledge and skills around racial equity. So we actually set it up as a companion site. That's how we named it back in 2009. And so that's how that started. And then Sally had met Shakti Butler. And again, I'm going to put names in here at Pat Harbor's Healing the Heart of Diversity, which folks may know. And I met Shakti in 2001 when we were both in a delegation for Project Change, which I mentioned earlier, to participate in the World Conference Against Racism and Xenophobia. So those are forever connections. And folks may know Shakti Butler as a filmmaker. Well, we started meeting regularly in 2012 to begin working on the Transforming White Privilege curriculum. And then we discussed merging evaluation tools, racial equity tools, and Shakti had a site called Racial Equity Learning. And so we merged all those sites together in 2016. And then we did our final upgrade and moved the platform in 2020, which reflects where it is today.
Thank you for sharing that. And we met shortly after that initial merger of the three sites just after 2016. So it's interesting as you tell the story to think back on like when we met and the story you were telling then and over the years about how the site was evolving. Thank you. So you've talked about how RET came to be and the folks that were involved in getting it started. Can you talk a little bit about the transition that happened at the beginning of this year when Equity in the Center adopted racial equity tools, sort of how that came to be, why you thought Equity in the Center was the right home for RET to help move it forward into its next chapter? And if you want to share a bit about why that transition was important and how you think that RET users will benefit from it moving forward.
So the RET partners had discussed always eventually having the RET site adopted by an organization that we felt could honor the principles of RET, who could manage the curation of the resources and in terms of expertise and analysis. And Equity in the Center just, your ethos reflected our hope of what we wanted to hold racial equity tools, a young, vibrant, multiracial organization who not only had the next necessary expertise, but also just the passion of resources. I mean, I felt like at that first meeting, Kay, you know, it just was in your DNA in terms of how Equity Center was just being formed, like just being able to share. And so we wanted to make sure that it was really going for that Equity in the Center could support where it needs to go to really meet the needs. You know, I think what's important in terms of the tools and the research and the tips and curricula that are on the site is, you know, I think one of the areas that has received minimum investment by the philanthropic sector is creating a communication infrastructure and consistent support for capacity building network. And RET offers one of the few avenues for individuals and organizations across the US and really beyond you know, to learn about the work that's going on in communities. I think so many times we're coastal privileged and we don't always think about how we're connecting the dots in between and how we're really lifting each other up. And I think this is so critical, especially now with the different attacks that are happening, and to figure out how we can be proactive and strategic. So, you know, I think as we talk about fighting for democracy, it's imperative that we have a strong communication loop and clearinghouse. And I think Equity in the Center is positioned to really take RET into the next chapter and really make sure that we're responding to the users, and we're also taking time to make sure that we're living our principles in terms of accessibility and language justice, and that we have the content that's needed to really support the movement. And so that's a little bit about it.
Thanks so much, Maggie. It is such an honor for you to have selected Equity in the Center to be RET's home moving forward. So I can't say thank you enough for that. And Andrew and I were really shocked and honored when you let us know, because we've always been in awe of your ability to curate all of these resources, like reviewing hundreds of emails and materials on a bi-monthly basis and then making decisions about what belongs in RET. And then your whole way of being and working with folks is such a reflection of the values that you're talking about. And that was a big part of why it was such an honor for you to say RET could be a part of EIC moving forward, because you've been a great leader in the field and also a great mentor to Andrew and myself over time. And the values that you've modeled have helped to shape how we've shown up in this work, along with other members of our board who have also mentored and supported us over time. But I just wanted to thank you and honor you, because who you are has been embedded in a way in Equity in the Center, because we built a relationship and you really modeled the values that you're talking about for each of us who's a part of the team. So thank you. And we continue to be in awe of the magnitude of work that you do. And we're in the process of figuring out how to bring all of that into Equity in the Center and learn from you as much as we can, even though we can't clone you. And I do want to the name for folks that what you do is very singular. And we're doing the best that we can, and we're excited to figure out how to honor your legacy and carry the work forward. You mentioned philanthropy, one of our favorite topics. So you along with your founding colleagues created this expansive library of tools and tips and materials for individuals, communities, and organizations to utilize. And one critical aspect of RET is that the resources are all free and easily accessible to folks. And you put a lot of time and labor along with your colleagues into curating and maintaining the library. And one thing that philanthropy hasn't historically done is underwrite this or invest in this kind of work. So capacity building and curation, philanthropy has invested in the dissemination of tools and resources often that it has created. But what you're doing is sort of pulling from multiple networks and creating something that's free and accessible to all. So could you talk a little bit about the importance of that free resource and the necessity of philanthropy to capitalize it at this particular moment in time?
Yeah. And I think part of it is, we have to celebrate the ground that we've covered just in the last 15 years as we celebrate this anniversary, because we know that that's what the conservative forces are reacting to is our progress. I think it's also important to put into context from a movement standpoint, like using the term structural racism, racism, white privilege. You know, there was, you know, before and continues the 15 years, there was internal pressure, you know, within organizations not to use it. And you can even track, you know, professional association conferences to see when it got brought into it. And I think that's an interesting tracking. You know, I remember when we launched Transforming White Privilege curriculum in 2014, we were like, do you really have to call it that? we can't buy it. White privilege in the name. And so, but now we're at this moment that we're getting external pressure and legislation to dilute, to stop using those terms of cheering, as well as funders are stopping the funding for people to use those terms that are focused on race. And for those who are speaking out for a humanitarian response to stop the war in Gaza and the genocide that's happening, I think it's important to note, and I think philanthropy needs to understand this a little bit, is as much as I'm excited about those 15 years of progress, we're also starting to see the gaps, the holes in the walls, because nonprofit and foundations that were doing that internal work over the years are being silent, are being in protective mode. They are not using their strength together collectively to use their voice to say, no, you know, this is our point of no return. And, you know, in my recent publication, one of the questions that I asked is, what's the political force or the spiritual quagmire that needs to occur for nonprofits and philanthropy to make this deep and sustained commitment? And so for philanthropy, the time is now, and to use the power that they have. You know, I would say one of the things that I've pondered a little bit when we talk about funding is, you know, being involved in supporting two national networks to support racial equity and justice. We had limited warning on when each of the funding stopped for both of those networks. And where would we have been if those networks were in place and being able to have the communication tools necessary? And, you know, you're right. RET had limited support over the years, only for upgrades. And so at this time, it's critical for Equity in the Center to be supported, to build the bench so you can be more responsive to the requests in the field. And also, you know, we operated on a shoestring budget to pay the tech bills. So, you know, in supporting Equity Center, you can ensure that this is an important clearinghouse that can really evolve with the movement. And I think Equity Center is going to take it in a place that is really needed and is responsive. And I know we're going to be doing that with a new page.
Yes. It is important to invest in Equity in the Center and in RET and in all the organizations that are doing movement building. You named so pointedly the challenge of this moment, because we have the challenge of the shifting equity and DEI landscape, which is, of course, tied to the SCOTUS ruling on Roe v. Wade as well. So like the domestic context and then the international context in terms of what's happening in Israel and with Gaza. And I think folks who are like me, so leaders of nonprofits, feel between a rock and a hard place. And I've had a lot of conversation with folks about their choice to remain silent. And Equity in the Center has tried to live into our values with some of the materials that we've shared. And there's a caution around being really explicit because many of our colleagues have lost funding. And so how do you hold the both and? And we're at a point of no return because genocide has a definition and the definition was met months ago. And folks aren't talking about that. And I don't think folks have the skills to talk about these things. So the way that you laid it all out and illustrated it in an accessible way, I find that colleagues have real difficulty with that. And many of the materials that are on RET are tools folks can use to help navigate this moment. And there's still a really huge gap in terms of our human capacity to talk about what's happening. I think individually and then within the community and within organizations. But there are a lot of resources on RET that people can use, and folks continue to struggle because they don't know how to name all of the hard things that we're witnessing and observing. And folks are rolling back, as you said, investment in things that say white supremacy or structural racism. I think there are a whole lot of other words, one of them being genocide, that people haven't actually begun to say. So the complexity of this moment is overwhelming in a way, and I appreciate how clearly you laid it all out. So thank you for inviting us into such a deep dialogue. for which there is no immediate resolution. You talked a bit about, well, not a bit, you talked a lot about the past 15 years and how RET has evolved and also how the broader landscape will evolve. You did speak a bit to how you hope RET will continue to evolve in partnership with Equity in the Center. Do you have a vision for what the future of RET looks like? Current landscape notwithstanding, or maybe the current landscape is the context for that vision. So how would you talk about the future of RET, or where do you hope RET is in 2, 5, 10 years in terms of contributing to the pushback against DEI, or so, well, supporting people through it would be a better way of saying it. But what are your hopes and dreams for RET as it moves into this next phase?
I think it's interesting to note that some of the organizations whose resources are on the site would not have been there 10 years ago. You know, when you look at their change trajectory of what has happened in these 10 years, they were still early in their racial equity change process. So I think it's just going back to the progress that we've made, I think it's important to note that and why we have over 5,000 resources right now. I think one of the things, you know, we just had our survey. We had 440 folks that came through. And, you know, one of the things that I'm going to continue to support this year is doing the spring cleaning, right? And to see if there's resources that are dated. So I do want to say to folks, though, resources from the 90s and the 2000 are still important to track in terms of lineage. I know you and I talked before this about the Structural Racism Caucus that came together in the early 2000s. There was 8 organizations that were trying to figure out the clarity of that definition and how to implement it. So I think one way that RET evolves is that there might be an archival site to make sure we are not losing the information about the trajectory in terms of practice and how the change process, and also looking at some of the issues of how they evolved. You know, we're talking about reproductive justice or food justice. Those words have evolved over the last 15 years. So how they went from race neutral to racial justice, I think is important. I think the other piece is just the technology is going to change. So how does AI fit in here? How can we use technology to connect people so we're not privileging coastal? What are the ways that we could connect and maybe change how the content is provided to the user? And, you know, one of our, the RET partners, one of our old ideas that I think is also new idea is, I think it might be interesting to see that folks in certain areas are actually curating those pages themselves. And what would that look like as we move further? Because we know and we hope that the trajectory for racial justice is we're going to keep expanding. We're going to continue to deepen and grow. I don't know if this is the place came to do. I wanted to make one comment about DEI backlash.
And oh, please do. I was going to ask you about that in follow-up tied to the pushback resources. So please.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a complex time with this backlash for folks in the field. Because on one hand, we want to defend and address DEI backlash, right? And ban books and CRT and all that. While at the same time, racial equity and racial justice practitioners have also been interrogating the DEI approach. Because we've seen that that approach is not sufficient for systemic change. It plays a role. It's an important contribution. But at the same time, we need to be at a place that we're holding accountability for DEI practitioners and we're in relationship with them in terms of that. You know, I don't believe DEI strategy is going to uproot racism. But I do think it can lay the groundwork. I think it's important to think about is when we're seeing organizations use DEI and adopt it, and not all, I'm going to make a very general statement. The label of DEI is sometimes used as a placeholder for change. And so then there's folks inside the organization who are really trying to do the structural work, the internal organizers of change. And it's often people of color, and it's often people with limited institutional power. And they're waiting for senior leadership and the board to catch up and understand racism and personal investment. And so we're, the DEI piece that we have to interrogate is how some of the organization has used it as a transactional, comfortable, majority-centered action while the waiting happens. And in the meantime, harm continues, right? With inequitable policies and et cetera. And, you know, folks leave because it's frustrating. And I think we need to continue to ask the question is what is the harm? Because that is continuing as we're in this waiting game for folks in power to really respond and be responsible for the change that's necessary.
Thank you for flagging that. And as practitioners, I feel like we talk about that harm and we help folks to navigate it and give language to it and to come up with policies and practices within the boundaries of, as you described, whatever the organization's leadership is authorizing and permitting, because there is so much that can't happen with equity work unless it has been funded, authorized, blessed, socialized. We spend a lot of time, I think, talking about that. But to your point, I don't think there's broader awareness of it. And I think on the part of leadership, they don't see what's happening as harm. And often the knee-jerk response is, well, you should be grateful that we're doing whatever it is that we're doing, which just reflects, as you said, where they are and how far they haven't come on this topic. Though in the last 15 years, as you're saying, there has been change and harm continues. So how do organizations push through that and transform? And Equity in the Center is trying to talk more about shifting from that transactional DEI approach to transformational race equity. So a couple of questions for you as we also talk about your work beyond RET. So if a leader or a member of an organizational team is looking to move beyond that transactional DEI approach, where would you recommend that they begin on RET? And then how can they connect with you and find your broader work, such as the webinar series, the cohort program that you're leading under a different banner, sort of how can they connect with you to access those resources and, you know, where should they start?
Yeah. I mean, one of the places that I typically ask an organization to do prior to really ask for me and the folks that I work with to come into an organization is I ask them to go to the organizational change page that's in the planning section. And we have lots of case studies there. I find it helpful for people to read the case studies and to be able to see, because I think sometimes folks like, I want an assessment. I want, you know, some training. I want, you know, to look at policies. And there's a scaffolding in place. And I think it's helpful to read other people's stories to understand how they were layering it and what were some of the variables that they were considering within their organization. I think the second piece that I would also ask is, how do you view the spectrum of knowledge and skills within that organization? Because then I would take you up to fundamentals, into the concepts area, and based on that spectrum, I would say, what are some reading materials that you could put out there to your staff? Because that helps folks sort of lay the foundation for what will be a very disruptive change process. And I think that's critical to help folks get ready and immerse themselves in what's coming up. As you know, one of my recent publications is Transforming Organizations by Operationalizing Racial Justice. And it really talks about that scaffolding that I was referring to, like how do you put an internal team together? What does an organization assessment look like before, during, and after? What, you know, how do we get to an action plan? And lots of resources are in there from RET, all curated. And so one of the things that I'm offering at this point is a 5-part webinar series for external consultants who have been doing this work of operationalizing racial justice for the past 10 years or so or less. And so it launches next Wednesday. So I'm super excited about that in terms of moving forward. And I think a lot of those information that's shared in there, if you go to the ACT tab of racial equity tools and go into organizational change, you'll see some of the policy information, how to change organizational practices, just even questions to ask as you begin or continue this process.
Thank you. I know as part of releasing the podcast, we're also going to link the things that you've mentioned so folks can easily access them. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about that we haven't touched upon?
I think, I guess, because you know I love to share my opinions about things.
Fire away, or please share. That's a more abundant way of framing it.
I think the one piece that I would just say in terms of the organizational change process that, you know, for me, it's evolved over the years in terms of how I do it, what I'm thinking about. And I think one of the approaches that we've used is we meet people where they are, and we meet them at their comfort level, and we sometimes stay away from explicit terms, and we give them bite-sized pieces of information based on their tolerance. And then we facilitate a few cognitive dissonance activities and hope that they're ready to go. And I guess I just want to offer folks, you know, another approach is really also connecting with people's values and with their vision, and just ask them, what would an organization look like and feel like if you practice rigorous humanity? What would it look like if you were operationalizing racial justice? And so then the connection is more connecting with similar values, building relationships, and to begin engaging the work in your co-vision together in order to move the organization. And so that's one of the areas that I think shifting that approach so we can move to that liberatory practice, I think is one important piece for us to consider with the organizational change.
Oh, thanks for outlining that and for naming liberation as the ultimate goal. Because as you've said earlier, we want to dismantle white supremacy, we want to dismantle structural racism, and beyond that is liberation. And often, so many of us feel that the intermediary steps, as well as that broader vision, that it's not possible. And folks have been able to carve out spaces within organizations and in communities where they're able to tap into and achieve some of that liberation just by introducing new practices into the organization. One thing you said, well, you said a lot of things that were interesting, but you began with that latest vignette or anecdote about how you work with folks who may not be ready for explicit terms, and then you laid out a process that was still values aligned. So I wanted to come back to that, because often when Equity in the Center works with organizations, or if I'm coaching someone or just talking to someone who's a colleague or that I meet in passing and we end up talking about DEI, folks don't feel that holding things in the way that you described is actually possible. And generally, it's because they don't have the skills to do so, kind of like we were talking about before in terms of deepening capacity to say and persist and hold people through hard things. So how do you, or what do you think for those of us who are learning and growing in our practice? How do you strengthen the muscle to hold that kind of a conversation where you're not necessarily saying white privilege or white supremacy or structural racism or whatever term it is that might make a particular organization uncomfortable, yet you're pushing them into that conversation about collective humanity? I don't think many people I encounter don't know where to begin or how to do that. And I do think the lack of capacity to hold that conversation is related to what we were talking about earlier, about our broader ability to not persist through and name hard things that are happening in the world. And that's just one thing I wonder about as a practitioner. I think we can coach folks through it. So I have a sense of, you know, how do I do that when I'm working with someone? But just wondered from your vantage point, how would you encourage people to lean into the competencies and the skill sets that will allow them to participate in, and then perhaps over time to lead those types of conversations where you're talking to someone who may not be about racial justice necessarily or explicitly, but you're able to meet them where they are in a way that is values aligned to racial equity and justice, if that makes sense.
So a really easy question, Kay. Thank you so much for that. So I guess two things were coming up for me when you were talking is, you know, part of the values aligned is just really connecting with folks, just people, creating a relationship with each other. And some of the places that we've gone, we had this activity in Transforming White Privilege about accumulated advantages and disadvantages. And it started out with some questions about your family. Like, what did you learn about your family about work? What were the messages in your family about money? You know, about really basic, about housing. You know, did you always have stable housing? Not asking directly like that, but, you know, getting into a conversation. Because in some ways, by knowing that family history of, and I'm specifically talking to more about white folks, by folks naming some of those troubles that they had. So some of the challenges, whether it was about housing or financial, and then to widen their perspective of that. What's the impact when then we look at some of the racial disparities, right? And then what's the impact as we look at that trajectory? But one, you're making that relationship connection. You're finding out your entry points from their family standpoint. And then you're being able to help them connect the dots or just share a headline. It's not like you're doing a racism 101, but it's beginning to share a headline where they might pause and say, oh, really? I didn't know about Black maternal health and what was going on and what was the impact of what was going on with the racial disparities. So those are some of the ways. I think the other piece that I it has been recent for me in the last decade or so that, and a few people influenced me to do this, is I really need to center love. And really think about, as I think of other people's humanity, how do I need to think about their support and what would it be for them to be in relationship with me working together for justice? And so I need to enter in with centering love and not putting out a scenario or forecasting a scenario of how I think they will react and more being present with that in mind, with that value in mind. And that's helped me to pause many times when sometimes I get frustrated, my anger goes up, I really want to say something difficult, and I pause and I try and remember that because we're in this for the long term. Nothing's going to be solved on the short term or about racism. So we need to figure out our strategy in order to do that.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. That's powerful. And philanthropy is love of humanity, even though it doesn't always feel like that in terms of how philanthropy is structured and the outcomes that it does or does not invest in for communities or for particular communities. I understand what you mean about centering love, and that is something that I've learned over time. Like, I've heard colleagues when I spent time in education, and Carmita Simon of Surge Institute in particular, talking about cultivating leaders and organizations that love our babies, so love Black children. And I think that was my entry point to thinking about what you're describing, because love is universal and contextual in some cases. And so how you enter that dialogue with individuals or organizations is necessarily different each time, but underlying it is still love of humanity. But it may be about children, it may be about elders, but there's a way to access that for all the folks that you're working with. And I think sometimes the getting to know you and the relationship building that you're talking about can, at least for me as a practitioner, is learning that person and their individual history, because that path to the broader perspective and openness to people who are different or not from ourselves begins with the cycle of socialization, which starts, as you described earlier, at home. So who are your people and how do you connect to them? And so that love can be accessed in a variety of ways, but I found that centering people in their lineage and their story and their understanding of the world, that's how you tap into what they believe themselves to deserve, their children to deserve, and extending that love beyond this small circle of people that they've been socialized to believe only deserve it.
Beautifully said.
So, thank you for sharing that. Anything else we didn't cover?
No, I had fun just hanging out with you for a little bit. It's precious time.
Yes, this was fun. Thank you so much. It is always such a pleasure and a blessing to spend time with you, Maggie. I've learned so much from you over the years. So thank you.